Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program from WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond. Please join hosts Emma Johnson and Mia Beach for news, stories, and insights into the prison system. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, or a request submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. Here on KiteLine, we hope to help these words along across the prison walls. Before we get started with this week's theme, we want to share some prison-related news.
According to the Indiana News Service, the Indiana Senate will soon vote on Senate Bill 9, which would remove the lifetime ban that prevents anyone who has been convicted on felony drug charges from receiving the benefits of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Emily Weichert Bryan, executive director of the network of food banks called Feeding Indiana's Hungry, says the ban was originally established as part of welfare reform legislation in the 90s, but that it actually hurts those who end up in prison because after they're released, they can't always find a job and are not able to receive help buying food. Weichert Bryan says Indiana is one of the few states that have not yet removed the ban. She says that people just getting out of prison make around $10,000 a year, but that in Indiana, the minimum amount required per year for a single person to be considered self-sufficient is over $18,000. Although food banks are providing meals to over a million Hoosiers, they're still having trouble meeting everyone's needs. Supporters of Ohio prisoner Sean Swain have issued an emergency request for call-in support. Swain began a hunger strike on December 26th and as of January 12th had lost 30 pounds. Although they have not received consistent information from the prison about Swain's well-being, his supporters believe that he remains on hunger strike, which means he has reached the point at which his body is in severe physical danger. They ask that you call Deputy Director of Operations Casey Barr at 513-932-3388, extension 2005, as well as the office of Warden's Assistant Greg Kraft at 513-932-3388, extension 2010.
Prison rebel Amir Jaja Davis has been languishing in close custody segregation at Donaldson Correctional for his alleged role in the wave of riots and strikes that struck Alabama prisons last fall. The prison struggle in Alabama helped to catalyze the historic national prison strike last September and has been an ongoing force for anti-authoritarian resistance on both sides of the walls. You can show your support for Amir by calling into Donaldson Correctional Facility and demanding that this prison rebel be released from close custody. As this new tide of rebellion rolls across the country, we need to stay true to the long-term relationships we've built with those resisting on the inside. Call Donaldson at 205-436-3681 and ask to speak to Warren Bowling and Ms. Bonner.
Resistance is growing in Delaware against the practice of serving a substance called Nutriloaf in prisons. Inmate Kevin Dickens calls it, quote, baked slop, unquote. A reporter who tasted the loaf reported it to be bland, brownish, and earthy, between the consistency of a loaf and a casserole. It's an unpalatable meal substitute that some prisons serve inmates whom they consider to pose disciplinary problems. Some states are ceasing to serve special diets to such inmates, but Delaware prison officials are maintaining the use of Nutriloaf in these cases. The loaf is served on a piece of brown paper and utensils are not allowed. Typically, it's served for misbehavior involving food or bodily wastes. One reason for its declining use is that years of lawsuits around the country have contended that serving it is cruel and unusual punishment. Prison officials, however, insist that the loaf is not intended as punishment, but is used as behavior management to control inmates whose disruptive behavior threatens the safety of prison operations.
On February 2nd, prisoners seized control of a building with Delaware's James T. Vaughn Correctional Center, taking at least four staff hostage and making a series of demands. Earlier, this message had been released via one of the hostages. The prisoners need somebody to hear their demands. The prisoners are against improper sentencing orders, status sheets being wrong, oppression towards the inmates. We're trying to explain the reasons for doing what we're doing. Donald Trump. Everything that he did. All the things that he's doing now. We know that the institution is going to change for the worse. We got demands that you need to pay attention to, that you need to listen to, and you need to let them know. Education. We want education first and foremost. We want a rehabilitation program that works for everybody. We want the money to be allocated so we can know exactly what is going on in the prison. The budget. The standoff ended after 18 hours when guards used construction equipment to smash through a wall, surprising and overwhelming the prisoners. One hostage was found dead.
In this episode, we introduce a new topic, going off paper. When prisoners finish their time and re-enter the free world, they confront a whole host of barriers and questions that extend the hold that institutions have on them well past their on-paper sentences. To begin, we hear a recently released anarchist prisoner who reflects on his time outside prison and the reactions he faces when people learn about his record. And then we move on to hearing about specific barriers to housing that ex-prisoners confront here in Bloomington. The last piece of the puzzle is Mikol Siegel's interview with Jared Wall, who, after serving 26 years, had to overcome legal and social barriers in order to simply exist in a small Indiana city.
To speak generally, it's like huge taboo to like have a felony, be a convict, be spend time in jail for more than just like being drunk in public and doing a drunk tank overnight. Mm-hmm. Being on probation or parole, all those things are huge taboos. I mean, you have to mark a box on your job application and you're probably going to have that job application thrown away because you mark on that box. Unspoken, like, cultural sin to have, like, been in one of these places or been charged or found guilty. Whenever they find out or when I come to sharing it with them, it's like, whoa, okay. I can feel like the shift in their body.
And do people tend to ask you a lot of questions about that?
Most of the time they ask, and then, like, they ask and then they get scared because they're getting answers. And then they kind of pull back and go, whoa.
Yeah, so it definitely has changed your relationship with people that you didn't know before. Like when you're meeting people for the first time.
Totally.
It's very different.
Yeah.
One of the projects that we did last year, after we heard reports from so many folks in Bloomington who simply couldn't find housing, was that me and a few interns at New Leaf New Life and the Transition Support Center started to call all of the landlords in town and pretended that we were formerly incarcerated. So we'd have, and I used my like sweet little voice and said like, hey, I'm interested in like this rental I read about. And we talked for a little while and I was a nice person for a couple minutes. And then I asked the question, will you accept someone who has a record? And no one even asked me what my record was. It was just a flat no. And we did find, and these were like all the companies in town. Yeah. We did find a couple individual landlords simply by word of mouth that like, oh, I know, like my brother knows this guy who might rent to someone because like he knew someone who was incarcerated and would be cool. And so we have these like little rabbit trail connections for individual rentals. But more often than not, we see clients at New Leaf who sometimes have 2 and 3 jobs and have nowhere that will rent to them. And they throw away application fees over and over and over again and often give up on having a space to actually live and end up couch surfing if they're lucky. And the couple places that we could find that were willing to rent to folks with records have so few units available that they don't want their name released. And they were real specific, like, yeah, we could probably do it for this one person, but like, don't put us on a list of a place that will rent to people who have records, which was really sort of heartbreaking. And like I said, there are some of our clients who end up having two or three part-time jobs, but for a lot of folks, places to work end up being real similar barriers, especially depending on their charges. And often people sign to get out, so they'll sign to charges, not really realizing how certain charges will pose barriers for the rest of their life. So I knew a woman who forged her own check for $13 at a gas station, and now has fraud charges that are financial fraud charges that will never let her work anywhere. And we see this over and over again, that people are willing to sign to plea deals because it gets them right out, but then they have barriers to work and certainly to housing for the rest of their lives. And I think that we've also seen an increase in many of the very low-level positions, the like positions that often are filled with high schoolers, increasingly refuse folks with records access. Largely, that's probably because we have such a huge pool of freshmen who come in here and who are happy to flip burgers at McDonald's. But I've heard that just in the last couple of years, the way the McDonald's around here have franchised, that there was a woman who I work with who's in the jail now, who said that she worked as a manager for 2 years and then was fired because they decided after she'd worked her way up to manager and then been a manager for 2 years that they were no longer going to employ anyone who had a record. And so she'd worked there for 4.5 years and then was fired because of a record that was before, that she got before she had ever started to work for them. And so it's interesting and horrifying that we're seeing some of these refusals. I've also heard that places like Marsh, when you check the box on their online form, it automatically throws away your application. And there are a lot of big companies that now pay to use this screening. It's also reported from folks who are incarcerated that a number of the temp agencies won't represent them at all because all of the actual companies that the temp agencies represent have specifically asked them to filter out anyone who has a criminal record. And so instead of serving as an access point for people to go and get temporary jobs, they become barriers. They become gatekeepers to any sort of low-level work.
This is Nicole Siegel. I'm sitting here with Jared Wall, my friend and former student who was incarcerated in the Indiana Department of Corrections for 26 years. Jared, it's great to see you again. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk today about your experience of being out. You've been out 18 months. Mm-hmm. I'd like to hear you talk a little bit first about what it's been like to get some documents, to get a job, and to apply for school.
Well, first of all, documents. Those of us who've been incarcerated so long, we are not in the database for the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. So basically, when I try to go there, they say you have no driving record. Well, I had a license when I was 16. So I went there, and I actually took them my license from back in probably 88.
Oh my God,
I actually had
that.
It. My mother had
wow.
it. I couldn't believe it. So I was told that would be fine. Uh-huh. That would be proof of a driving record. Well, I took right. it in there, and first of all, she says, what's your social security number? I'm like, it's right on the license. She's like, uh-huh. no. Back then, that's what they did. They put your social security number before theft identity and all that on the license. And she had never even seen one that old.
Wow.
Basically, I think it was probably her call that started this whole process. But then she says, well, we have no proof. I can't use that because basically I don't know what it is. You have to have a permit.
So she thought it was like a fake ID, that you were making it up.
Honestly, no, I don't think she thought that. I just think she didn't know what the heck to do.
Uh-huh.
She just didn't know what to make of it.
So it was sort of capricious on her part.
I really took it that way. And then I tried to file a complaint on it and appeal mm-hmm. it, but it was more like they said the decision's already been made.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, I had to go through another process. Well, fortunately, a good friend of mine had gone through this. He was out about released probably 6 months before I was, mm-hmm. served 26 years also. And he had gone through this himself. It had taken him a long time to figure it out. Fortunately, I had his information. But you have to apply for a hardship license. And once you do, it's fairly automatic. Now, I applied for it. Waited. He says, it's a really quick deal. I wait 2 weeks. I call. They have no record of it. And they ask me, they say, did you send it certified? I'm like, no. So I called again. And the same question they asked me right away, did you send it certified? I'm like, really? So, send it certified. Ended up happening fairly quickly.
They lost it the first time.
They lost it. So I get the license. So okay. That was a difficulty. Now,
mm-hmm.
For years, I had been looking forward to getting out and going to Ball State University, my alma mater, where I have mm-hmm. 4 degrees, associate, 2 bachelors, or 3 degrees from Ball State, and worked mm-hmm. for them in the prison yeah. for years.
Yeah, you said in our earlier interview
yeah.
that you ran the Ball State program basically as yeah. a clerk, as the education clerk.
Yeah.
You were responsible for all, for administration, curriculum, registration, all kinds of things.
All that for probably over 12 years.
So,
I already have a relationship with Ball State. However, Ball State anthropomorphizing because that's not a single entity.
So how did you know you wanted to go to Ball State?
Well, for one, I really like their psychology program. They have a great program where it has a focus on clinical psychology as well as social psychology. You can get actual dual majors. So social, it's nice because you're looking at the problems from both ends, the individual problems, but yet also recognizing there are larger social and systemic issues that influence the individual. And I feel like it has a great focus because it help you make a change on both, which is what's needed. It's a great program. They have a great assistantship program they're known for. Look forward for years going. I study psychology every day. I have stacks and stacks from different schools of psychology I've studied. Love it, though. But I was preparing, got out, studied for the GRE probably 6-8 hours a day when I was first released. Didn't even have a license yet for an ID and went up there and took the test. I just had the paper license at that point. Tried to get special approval to take even the test because I didn't have a permanent ID. So all
that's
these
a lot of steps
crazy
right there,
hoops I'm
get,
going through
is
just nuts because I'm trying to meet this deadline so I can try to get in. Well, if you're a felon, okay, there are certain questions they ask on college applications.
Right.
Have you ever been kicked out of school? No. Have you ever had a misdemeanor? No. Have you ever had a felon? Yes. It goes through a whole other process then. With Ball State, it's called Exceptional Admissions Committees. Basically, it's a felon board, a screening board.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing about this is, on this board, they have faculty, but then they also have students. So here, I'm undergrad. So basically, I'm having 19-year-old kids make a decision on me and my life.
What kind of information did they have in order to make that decision? Were you able to go talk to them?
That's the shame. They will not meet with you. They will not let you represent yourself. They will not meet you person to person. They refuse to imagine you might be a person as you are today because everything has to be documents, and they want all sorts of legal documents from, in my case, it was 1989. So here they want these documents that are 25, 30 years old. You can get character reference letters, and I did, but it's almost like made me feel like they're almost looking at the crime as like a static state. Whatever happened 25, 30 years ago, that's what it is now. I joke and I say, okay, I wonder if I walk in the room, what are these people going to do? They're going to dive under the table. It's just so, I don't know, ridiculous. I just don't understand it. Then it's like you don't have the ability to represent yourself as you are now or as you have been now. And it's just, or even, they're taking a crime 30 years ago.
Yeah.
That's what you are. They deny me. First year, they said they wanted to put me off for a year, let me be out longer. In my mind, it was very frustrating. I looked forward for this for years. It was probably one of my greatest disappointments since I've been released, and certainly my earliest.
Well, and I remember how hard you were scrambling to get the stuff out of the way to get the GRE, to get the ID that you needed to take the GRE, to get the ID that you needed to get the ID that you needed to take the GRE.
Inside and out, this was my singular focus and mission for so many years. I had another university also I applied for, University of St. Francis in Fort Wayne. They deferred me my first year. They said, we're not going to deny you. We love your references. I had tenured professors. I had a judge, all these people. A person who owns his own software development company, a CEO for a newspaper. I mean, great references. And this University of St. Francis really liked me for what I'd written about myself and then and my references as well. I requested to speak for myself for them, too. They're like, we don't do that. Don't worry, because we like you. We have, you know, your references are stellar. Don't worry, but we want to defer you for a year. Your file's still going to be active. We're not denying you, deferring you. So after a year, I still wanted to go to Ball State, applied again, and they drug it out months after they should have, and finally waited till the deadline for selection for the counseling psychology, and then emailed me that morning, 10 o'clock in the morning. I remember I got an email, and they said that the graduate department denied me based on the Exceptional Admissions Committee's recommendation to deny me.
Whoa, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. So they didn't actually consider your application because the Exceptional Admissions Committee had told them not to consider it.
They just give their
And they didn't even tell you.
Yeah.
They didn't even have the grace to tell you when they made the decision. First they let it wind all the way through to the deadline.
The Exceptional Admission Committees won't. And then the actual graduate school waited all the way till it was my last day, to be accepted. Interestingly, the counseling psych department should have thrown my application out months earlier. They held on to it. I really think they liked me and they wanted me because we had been communicating for some years even before I got out. But the graduate school denied me. They said based on the recommendation of the Exceptional Admissions Committee. And then the real kicker was the Exceptional Admissions Committee said they would not review me again. No appeal. And that was the hurtful part.
That's a slam door.
That was a slam. That was there. So I ended up quickly went back to University of St. Francis just thinking I need to get going somewhere. And they, through a process, accepted me. But even that was a conditional accept.
But you're enrolled there now. You're actually in classes.
I'm in classes. I'm taking 9 hours, which they consider full load. Really good program, good people. Basically on that, they just said that the only conditional is that they couldn't guarantee that I would get licensure by the state, and they wanted me to know that and agree to that.
So hang on. So you're enrolled in a degree program to get a degree that you might not actually be able to use as a practitioner?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
what's going on with that? Who has the say over that? What's the process for deciding yes or no?
That's, again, why even going to school now that I've looked forward for so many years is not stress-free, because I might be getting all the student debt and pursuing an education in something that I may not be able to use. Now, I could still do research. I could still... Used to be I could teach. Now they're going to what's called KCRIP, new accreditation. You have to to be able to teach now, even. You're going to have to be licensed. So, I mean, I'm running into that possibility as well. That's kind of why I'm looking at another field as well. A similar field is occupational therapy. Again, I feel like they're a little more of a mix between physical therapy and psychological therapy. But they have what's called NBCOT, National Board for Certification for Occupational Therapy. And they have what's called a character and pre-review process. A couple states have that for psychology, like Texas sometimes.
Is it specifically for former prisoners?
No. This is for anyone maybe who had some misconduct within their profession.
Okay.
Misdemeanor, felon, whatever.
I see. But so it's like, is this going to be worth it to me to pursue?
You have to basically pay the fee, and they're going to tell you, but they go through the background check. Again, tons of documents. I've had to go to courthouses, everything else. And all sorts of places to get different documents, and some of them don't even exist now after this long. But they were telling me ahead of time, yes, we'll let you take the national board, or no, we won't. If it's a no, then I won't pursue it. The only thing I look at is in the state of Indiana for psychology, if that's the program I keep going in denies me, then I can always try another state, another region.
But your life is here, and all your networks are here.
My life is here, and all my networks are here. May not be in the future. I mean, it's...
Yeah, yeah. What about in other arenas of your life, not education, in terms of, you know, being accepted by your hometown, finding a job, stuff like that? How has that been?
I have to say, I'm from a small rural community, and I'd say there it's been really a good reception. Great just country folk, religious folk, good people, and it's been open arms. I can't say how many times I've run in. I'll never forget this, a guy who's about 80, I've known him since I was a kid. The minute he saw me, he just snatched me up in a big bear hug. But people that were supportive in the community like that. Now, on the other hand, when I first got out, I didn't have any money. Just broke, just starting out. So I'm going to the free health clinic for health services. And they had a program at the YMCA where if you're in a free health clinic, you can get in and go work out free. So I was. And it's unfortunate I have a big case in a small town, just being a small town.
It was a pretty well-known case?
Yes. Yeah, unfortunately. So I went there twice, and then YMCA called the free health clinic and told them that I could not come back. My crime was not against children. It was not a sex crime. Not knocking any other crimes. I'm just saying no understandable reason for them to deny it. And, you know, that's where I always got. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I really was not expecting that. Here at a charitable institution, the YMCA, what's the C stand for, you know, Christian, really took me back. After months of trying, I finally met with the director of the YMCA, and he was decent enough to go at breakfast. We went and talked, and basically I aired everything to him. I just told him that, again, the old Y that they used to have is more downtown, more with a street mission. Now it's kind of on the north side, doctors, lawyers, more of the clientele now. It's a whole different, So I told him about that. I got him about what's the C for. I mean, you know, we were able to speak. We were able to speak openly, and I appreciate that. But basically it came down to is someone had complained who they're basically in debt, YMCA, from building, and 4 or 5 years the debt's due. And basically it comes down to money donators were contributors were ones that complained, and they won. He was talking to the board, and he also said, he made me realize he has a board he has to answer to, and then, of course, contributors of money... benefactors. I knew I was going to lose even when we were talking, but then he was talking about at the time that they were going to make a process perhaps of, it was very insulting, but I was willing to go through it just to help felons after me. But it would be like a mentoring program where I could go in there maybe for my first 3 months and have someone almost like chaperone me or be a supervisor there with me. Like, What, prison to, like, guard?
Show you how to ask for a towel or how to
use
the
to make sure I don't take
weights.
A towel, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Versus,
right.
you know, use one.
Right.
I don't know. It was really. I mean, but he was trying to find some compromise, so I give him uh-huh. props there. I mean, I give him, you know, his uh-huh. credit, but never heard anything more from him. And I checked in with Indiana Civil Liberties Union, and he just said, hey, you know, it's a not-for-profit. He says, and prisoners are, former prisoners are not a protected group. So mm-hmm. he says, unfortunately, they can do that. It's kind of interesting. These rejections take a toll. It's unfortunate because I feel like I am, this is almost ironic, a little colder person mm-hmm. than when I first got out of prison 18 months ago. You would think that, yeah, coming out of prison, you're hard. And actually, I feel like
yeah.
I was more wanting to help people. I was more ready to help. I was more, it wasn't that I was just naive. It wasn't that. But I just feel like that rejection has taken, mm-hmm. it's worn on me. It's taken
yeah.
its toll. And it's unfortunate I fight against that, but I know how to fight against that because I had to do it most of my life. You know, if
sure.
not, then you shall be angry to where it changes you or be discouraged so much that it changes you or become bitter or anger or, I don't know. So I fight that, but I feel the effect nonetheless. And so I tell people even with prison, you know, I mean, I fought all that, but nonetheless it still had its effect. And even though I fight this, I can tell it's having its effect. And it's unfortunate because there are so many venues I would like to help. Like even right now, I mean, I have a job where I have, it's a good job. I like it, good people, but I mean, I should be in a job where I'm using my education. I should be in a job where I am helping others, and
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, I'm not. I feel like what I'm best at and where I can be of use the most, I'm not being, you know. Viktor Frankl talks about having life tasks, and I feel like I have some, but I feel like this doesn't work toward them.
This has been KiteLine. Anyone affected by the prison system in any form is welcome to write us via our P.O. Box, KiteLine Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. KiteLine wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you or someone you care about affected by the prison system? You can call us to record a message to be played on the air at 812-269-2512, or you can use this number to record a message to a loved one behind bars. You can hear previous episodes of our show or get more information on the prisoners or stories covered on KiteLine at our website, kitelineradio.noblogs.org. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. KiteLine is intended as a means of communication between people across prison walls. We are not responsible for all views expressed on the program. WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program are not responsible for the views expressed on the show. This has been KiteLine. Join us every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for more stories, news, and insights about the impact of prison on our communities. Thank you for listening. Thank you.